Welcome to Connect the Dots podcast, presented by Nine Dots and hosted by Jeffrey Klein. We explore stories of success and their multitude of dots that are connected along the way. Sharing these stories, our aim is to provide some context to the path of success, which is often paved with obstacles, challenges, victories, and celebrations. Thank you for listening. Here is your host, Jeffrey.
My guest today is amazing CEO Nick Baer from Saxby. And although he's not a Philly native, he's really embraced the city and he's having a huge impact on our community and our city, one Saxby cafe at a time. Nick shares his story and gives some great insights on how to pursue a successful career. Thank you for listening and enjoy. My guest today is Nick Baer, founder and CEO of Saxby's Coffee, a 30-unit Philadelphia-based hospitality business with a mission: make life better. Headquartered in Center City, Philadelphia, with cafes in six states and on many college campuses, Saxby's is growing fast, 30% a year fast. Saxby opened an experimental learning cafe at Drexel University, the nation's first entirely student-run cafe where students earn full academic credit for running it. Nick is currently the entrepreneur in residence at Cornell University's School of Hotel Administration and an adjunct professor at Drexel University, where he teaches a course in entrepreneurial franchising. He's a frequent guest lecturer at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, Temple University's Fox School of Business, and Penn State's Smeal College of Business. He serves on the board of the Franklin Institute, Big Brothers Big Sisters Independence Region, Drexel University's Steinbright Career Development Center, and as a corporate council member of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Nick was named the 2017 Entrepreneur of the Year by the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce, and he resides in our fair city with his wife and son. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's great to be here.
So I like to start at the beginning. Where were you born, and what did your parents do for a living?
So I was born in Chicago.
We won't hold that against you.
Yes, exactly. Although, you know what? I think there's a lot of similarities between Chicago and Philly. I think Chicago and Philly are more similar than Philly oftentimes gets compared to like a D.C. or a New York. But I'm now a Philadelphia fan, if that makes it a little more acceptable.
I had someone tell about when they became the Equinox, of when they spent more, they lived longer in Philadelphia than where they had grown up.
I'm getting there. I'm not quite there. Okay. So I did my first 18 years were in Chicago. So I was born to two Chicagoans. My mom was from the north side. My dad was from the south side. I grew up mostly on the south side of Chicago. You know, my parents actually met in college. My dad was a football player. My mom was a cheerleader. Unfortunately, they decided to have me before getting too far into college, so they both dropped out, had me, and you know, that was a really sort of developmental time in my life, because you know, the fact that my parents didn't get their degree and didn't see that all the way through, and also started a family so early, then having my brother about 18 months younger than me. So my parents, by the time they were 20 years old, they had two boys and no education.
What were they doing for work?
So my dad, you know, when my mom was pregnant with me, my dad needed to work. You know, his dad was a cop on the south side of Chicago. I didn't really want to go on the police route. So he pretty much was going to take any job he could get. And he begged his way on to the third, what they called the graveyard shift. He was sweeping floors in a warehouse on the west side of Chicago, Eastman Kodak, back when Eastman Kodak was a big company. And, you know, it was a good job in that he needed to be able to pay the bills and put a roof over our head. But it wasn't what my dad has ever wanted to do. You know, and unfortunately, because of the, sort of those early life decisions, he sort of stayed in logistics his whole life. You know, so 18 years later, so my dad begs his way onto the west side of Chicago, sweeping floors in the graveyard shift. 18 years later, literally the same month that I went away to college, first person in my family to go to college, my dad was promoted to the general manager of that facility. So we literally went from employee number 251 to number one. Wow. Over those 18 years. It was a really special thing for me to be able to be there to witness that, which is great because I learned grit and determination from that. But at the same time, I also learned that you need to set yourself up for success. And that was something that my parents really, really preached on me as a kid.
And as a kid, did you have any fantasy about being, you know, we talk about what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you want to be an athlete like your dad or, you know, an astronaut? What was Nick Baer's dream as a kid?
You know, it was always being an athlete. So I played baseball, basketball, and football since I was 5 years old. I played them all the way through high school, played baseball in college. So I always really liked sports. And growing up where we grew up, I mean, being a pro athlete was something that was actually on the radar. There were a lot of really good athletes growing up where we grew up. But as I started to turn a corner in middle school and then into my high school, that's where I started to realize that sports for me were going to be sort of a means to a different end. You know, it was going to give me other opportunities that I don't think I was going to be able to get if it wasn't for sports. So I was able to go to a private high school primarily because I was a good athlete. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a really good student in my middle school, but it wasn't necessarily the most academically rigorous middle school. So I was recruited to this school much more because I could throw a football, I could hit a, you know, pitch a baseball and shoot the basketball a little bit. So that opened up a whole new, you know, door for me. So as a kid, I certainly definitely wanted to be an athlete, but you know, that transitioned for me. You know, like it transitioned for me probably as I went to high school and certainly in college. Sports to me, although I played hard and I loved, you know, playing a sport and the camaraderie that came with it, it was absolutely a means to a different end.
Just out of curiosity, what position did you play?
I played everything growing up. I was a shortstop, outfielder, pitcher growing up in baseball. But then I just pitched in college. So right-handed pitcher. I was, you know.
My daughters play softball, and I've watched a lot of softball games. So I didn't grow up in the baseball world. You know, I was a basketball player. And so for me, being around that sport, even, you know, my son plays baseball. It's different.
I loved it. I loved it, you know, in high school because when I wasn't pitching, I was playing a position and hitting. Right. But then in college, they really want you to specialize. Right. So it became a little boring for me. Like, I would start and then I would, like, just support, you know, and it was, you know, I'd do my working out, but it was, that was a little bit of a hard transition for me. But so sports early, but then, you know, I would say, I always, you know, tell the story when I went to college, like I was a total fish out of water because it wasn't like, I didn't have parents and aunts and uncles telling me, like, when I went to college, this is how I approached it. So I was a total fish out of water. And I think the first week being on campus, my baseball coach asked me what I was looking to do. I think 1 week I told him I wanted to be a lawyer. The next week I told him I wanted to be a CIA agent. So it was changing a lot rapidly when I was in college.
Well, I want to go back to the early years for just a moment. You talked about your parents kind of instilling that value of grit. So was there any particular, like, first lesson where that really kind of changed the way you looked at your approach?
There were a lot. You know, it was a bit of an atypical upbringing because my parents were young, you know, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of challenges because of those things. They're more similar than different. They're both A-type, hard charging, you know, sort of yell out your grievance kind of people. So there were a lot of touch points in my childhood that stayed with me, you know, and that created a tough situation for them. So, you know, my parents split up a few times when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was about 6-7 years old, where you started to understand what those things meant, that was a big changing point for me. You know, the way that I've approached relationships, really of all kinds, since then has been very influenced by those early years of my parents. You know, fortunately, my parents have resolved all those things and they've you know, moved into having the great relationship they have today, but it was not great when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think the big formulative thing for me, my parents split up when I was relatively young, and it just really set the stage for me that I don't know why friends or people that are going to be close with each other are going to fight all the time. You know, and so I've really applied that in my life. Like, if there's negativity or drama with people in my personal or professional life, I make quick changes in those situations. And then on the flip side, people that are really genuine and, you know, they're comfortable with who they are and they, you know, make friends easily and they treat people well, I'll go to the end of the earth for that kind of person. So that was a really formulative thing for me. And you know what? It has a happy ending because my parents got back together and they're doing well. And I was able to sort of learn those things early in life that have been so steadfast to me in developing relationships.
And speaking of, you know, so were there people that you kind of still looked up to, whether they're sports people that were kind of role models to you about life as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you always look up to your parents, and I certainly did. But I remember my dad in particular always telling me, he's like, look, Nick, you know, the things that you feel like we do well, do them way better. And all the things you don't think that we do well, be better than that. You know, do it better. So it's not like he said, don't look up to me as a role model, because he's my dad. I always would look up to him as a role model. But, you know, in my first, like, you know, I would say birth through eighth grade, I don't look at a lot of, like, hardcore role models in that stage of my life. I had a seventh grade teacher, Mrs. Eichen, who I've stayed in close contact with, who she pulled my parents aside about midway through my seventh grade and was like, Mr. and Mrs. Bayer, you need to look at sending him somewhere else. You know, you need to send him to, you know, to a different place, you know, that's going to maybe challenge him a little bit differently than we're able to in this particular area in school system. So she has become more and more of, I was too young and dumb at that right. age to realize like she was a great mentor to me, but I've looked back on that now, like that was such a turning point for me. Mm-hmm. You know, me going ultimately to a different school, like that changed the whole trajectory for me. So Mrs. Eichen, and then in high school, I had a great basketball coach who was mm-hmm. just part of my friend, she's a total hard ass, you know, and he wouldn't put up with a lot of my stuff, both on the court and off the court.
Well,
on the court, I wasn't a good defensive player. Uh-huh. I really only liked being on the offensive side and shooting and scoring.
The Sixers have a few players like
that. Yeah, you know what? I still think that's the best way to play basketball, but that's probably why I'm not a pro basketball player or a coach. But and then he took the same approach off the classroom, you know, I think, you know, or off the court and in the classroom, where it was just it was a lot of tough love. But that was a good transition for me because that's sort of like how my dad was with me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went to school pretty far away from home and, you know, I didn't have much of that sort of home setup at that time. So Coach Meyer was a really, really great mentor to me. He taught me to not feel sorry for myself. He told me, you know, taught me to multitask and put in the effort and know that you're not always going to win. You're not always going to get things the way that you want. So Mrs. Eichen and Coach Meyer, teacher and a coach, were the big sort of mentors for me.
It's amazing how many I hear this from other guests and in general that, you know, I was very fortunate. I had some amazing teachers growing up and the impact they can have when you really need them.
Yep.
You know, and I, my parents are a great role model, but sometimes you need even that outside perspective that's not connected to you as closely as your parents are.
You have to.
To really help you.
Yeah, you have to. Like, I see it even with my son. He's only 3.5 right now, but if you keep hearing the same voice over and over and over, you start to tune it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, like, you're inherently going to have mentors outside of your immediate family.
Well, I coach my daughters in basketball, and I feel like they'll listen to anyone but me when I'm coaching them.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, they still want me. They still want me to coach them.
That's good.
We'll see. What was your first paying job?
My first paying job was as much as I can remember. I'm sure I. Actually, no. I was going to say McDonald's. So I've worked at McDonald's since I was 15 years old. I don't anymore, obviously, but I worked at McDonald's all through high school, you know, and that was really formative for me. But actually, my first paying job was my brother and I and a couple other neighborhood kids used to clean up the outside of this bar in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And the bar had like arcade games. And so we would go in there in the morning, like after I'm sure late nights in the bar, we'd go there in the morning, we'd like clean up around the outside and clean up on the inside. And he'd let us play like the arcades and then he'd give us like, you know, fried food for lunch. So we did that forever. We were always excited to be able to go to the bar and clean the place up.
Fantastic. Was there a particular arcade game there that you loved?
You know, I've never been like a game player. I think it was Mrs. Pac-Man, right. I think was the game that I liked playing. And Contra was a big game back in the day. So yeah, those were the two.
And now you said you went to college. Where did you go to college?
I went to Cornell.
Okay. And how did that shape kind of your early career in terms of what you wanted to do?
You know, I say this all the time because I've been, as you mentioned in the opening, so I've been an entrepreneur in residence mm-hmm. in Cornell's hotel management school for a long time at this point. And so I get the opportunity to be able to speak to a lot of students in general, but specifically at Cornell. And yeah, you can learn some tremendous things at really any college and university. But I think that the biggest thing that you can do is you can start to build a network there. So mm-hmm. you build a network of the people that you go to school with. And then now with things like social media or specifically LinkedIn, you can start building global networks with people you've never actually met in person before at 18, 19, 20 years old. So that's phenomenal. So I think that of all the things, I mean, obviously a kid growing up where I grew up and having sort of the upbringing that I had and then going to an Ivy League school, mm-hmm. you know, 1,500 miles away from home is a huge change. You know, I was a total fish out of water when I went there. So pretty much everything I experienced, I was experiencing for the first time. But I think that the network building to me mm-hmm. was huge. And I loved Cornell because there were some people who weren't, you know, didn't come from the most, you know, amazing backgrounds, but then there were a lot of people who came from a lot of amazing backgrounds, you know, and so I got to meet people from around the world, parents and families did so many different things. And so I got to, you know, tap into this network where it was almost like the world becomes your oyster. You know, you can go and do whatever it is that you want to actually go and be able to do.
And what was your major? Did you have you said lawyer, you know, you're talking about lawyer and CIA agent at different points. So were you studying political science?
Government and economics. That's my degree. So I was in the arts and science school. So most people who know Cornell are like, oh, you must have been a, you know, hospitality management guy. I'm like, I wish I was that smart to know that I should have been in there. But I was arts and sciences. I mean, because really when you were declaring a major, you know, at that stage, I think I was still in the, like,
I'm not sure
I'm going to be, you know, a lawyer or I'm going to be a CIA agent. I'm going to be one of those two things. The next thing I know, I'm graduating with a, you know, government economics degree.
Is there someone who you've met sort of from childhood through college, we'll go, that kind of really had that impact, aside from the kind of coach or that you met along the way, that was like, in terms of maybe an entrepreneur, because obviously that's become part of your life. Did you have examples of that growing up?
No, not much. I didn't. You know, my mom started a cake business when she was really young, when I was a baby. Like, she's a very talented sort of baker, and she's like very, very creative. The problem is we didn't live in a great neighborhood, and she opened up this really nice cake shop in a really not nice neighborhood, and so it didn't...
not the recipe for success.
Not the recipe for success, but, you know, she was so young when she was doing it, and I think back on it now, and I'm like, man, what grit and determination that took for her to do that, you know, and then watch her have to unwind the business, you know, and watch her have to like overcome that failure was huge. So I think that was probably my like greatest exposure to entrepreneurship. Yeah. I think about like in college, you know, so being a baseball player, I had a recruiting class of guys. We all came in the same class together. And many of us went to the same fraternity, and I could really pick any one of them. But there's one particular guy, Craig Morrow. He's actually the orthopedic surgeon for the Pittsburgh Steelers now in his 30s, which is pretty phenomenal. But I think back on Craig. I remember when I first met Craig, we were 18, and he had the maturity of like a 50-year-old. Mm-hmm. And he was just so disciplined and focused and efficient. Like, he knew everything that he wanted to be able to do. And he aligned social life and baseball and his studies all to those things. Like, his maturity and how he set his path was... I didn't have the maturity from 18 to 22, but I've always thought about Craig, and I've watched his star, you know, continue to rise. He was a total role model. I'm just a slow learner, so I didn't start applying those things until like my mid-20s. But
we all have our pace, right?
We all have our pace, exactly. I'm usually about 5 to 7 years behind, so I'm catching up at this point.
Done all right. So when did you realize that you were not going to be a CIA agent, and that perhaps business was more for you?
Yeah, so I, you know, going to Cornell, I talked about having the network and being able to connect into those things. So I used that network. My first summer, I did a finance internship. My second, I did a logistics internship in Charlotte. My third, I did real estate in Los Angeles. So I did all these different things to really sort of spread my wings and see what was out there.
And I liked taste of different things.
I liked every one of those things, but I didn't love any of them. None of them were what I like. Like, if I thought about waking up early in the morning, I'm like, I get to go do this. None of those things really flipped the switch for me. When I was about 22, so I was a decent baseball player. So I was, you know, being recruited and looked at to potentially be able to play in the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. And so I was considering that, but that didn't flip the switch for me either. You know, I wasn't going to be a first round pick. And I like to think that if I was going to be a first round pick, maybe that would have flipped the switch a little bit more. But I was going to be, you know, a mid round pick. And when I thought through that, I'm like, all right, so say you get drafted and you go to the, you know, the rookie league in Florida. Right. My heart didn't start to race. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was thinking about the other jobs that I had exposure to, and my heart didn't start to race. And
I'm just curious of one thing. How did you seem to know that you needed to love what you were going to do?
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Because obviously your parents didn't get a chance to even really explore that initially.
Well, so, I mean, that's where it came from. So when I was 21, 22, you start doing all of that recruiting. You have all these companies coming to campus. You start doing your recruiting, and that was a very different day and age. I graduated college in 2000. There were literally 10 times more finance jobs than there are today. And so in my circle of friends, it was either I'm going to do something specialized. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to go be a doctor. Pretty much everybody defaulted to finance. It was like pretty much everybody was going to finance. And I had that experience, and it wasn't what I loved. It just wasn't for me. I didn't love the culture of it. I wasn't necessarily that focused on wanting to move to New York. Like, it just wasn't what I wanted. So that switch never flipped for me. So I started to rack my brain. I'm like, baseball, all these other things. And in this like moment of sort of clarity, I thought about my parents, you know, who worked for at that stage 22 years of my life doing things that they didn't love. You know, and I talk to my parents about this all the time, you know, and they're at a stage now, my mom is retired, my dad is, you know, working a job that he's like, it's not what defines me, it's not my passion, if I could do it all over again, like he, you know, he'll talk about that. And so at 22, I was like, I watched my parents for years get up, have long commutes, go to a job they didn't love, couldn't wait to get out of there, and then would dread on Sunday that they had to go back to work on Monday. And so that's when I knew, I'm like, I'm going to love what I do. You know, I'm going to absolutely love what I do. But I didn't have a whole lot of clarity on what that meant at 22. But that is a huge hurdle to climb, you know, is when you know that that's your thing. Because I stared at money. I could go into finance and you can control your destiny. Right. If you put in the 105 hours, mm-hmm. you outwork the guy and the girl next to you and you step over, like, it was there.
There's a path.
But the money didn't flip the switch for me. Like, that wasn't the thing that I was going to be passionate about. I felt like I was going to be at my best if I did something that would, you know, really, really turn me on. That would really make me want to, like, my heart would race when I thought about doing that thing.
That's fantastic. I mean, I hope my children, I have 3 children, and that's my hope for them. Is that they will, you know, I've done a lot of different things in my career, and I feel like now I'm getting to the thing I really love. And so, yeah, it's something you... It's hard to teach that.
It is. Well, because our system is sort of set up not to teach that.
Right.
You know, our system is set up to be like, tell people early on, as a young person, when someone asks you what you want to do, say something impressive.
Right.
So then you start to believe what you say because you're being coerced to say something impressive. And then in America, we're capitalistic, you know, materialistic. And so we think that we've got to pursue things that make money. And oftentimes when you're going to make decisions to pursue something you're truly passionate about, money's not the first thing that comes, you know. No. It takes a while for that to come. Yeah. So we're almost set up not to do that.
I always talk to people about the fact that it's like if you love what you do, then it's not really work.
Yep.
You know,
yeah, you feel like you've never worked a day in your life.
Right.
You know?
My dad and my grandfather, who were both judges for years and years, that's what they from. You gotta want to get up and go to work every day.
Yep.
You know, I think exactly. It's really important. So we haven't finished. Where so you got from knowing you wanted to do something you loved? How did you figure out what that thing was?
So, you know, at 22, I didn't know what that was. Mm-hmm. So I chose not to go into finance, which, again, at that time was a hard thing to choose against. I knew I wanted to have a little bit more business exposure. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to be in a position where I could understand how a business actually moves and rotates and manage people. I knew I was a people person. You know, like, I go to this, you know, amazing college and part of this amazing baseball program with just phenomenal people on my team. In my junior year, those phenomenal people choose me to be the captain of the team, which to this day is actually a really sort of thing that I'm really proud of, because these were really smart, really talented people who are like, that guy does things the right way, you know, and we would want to follow him as a leader. So I knew that I needed to be something in the people world, but I loved business. And so I chose to go into consulting right out of school because it was going to give me an opportunity where I went to an organization.
Touch
a lot of different things, like see the inner workings of how a business either moves or doesn't move. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this particular opportunity was one where I could start to manage people at an early age, you know, because, and thank God I did that, because I realize now how important being able to manage people is in the operation of any business.
And so, but being chosen to be the captain of the baseball team, Did you have the sense like I want to be in a leadership role? Like, that was that always pretty clear to you that you wanted to kind of have other people that you were looking, you know, providing that leadership for?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that definitely started to dawn on me at that stage. Like, because mm-hmm. when you're a kid and people right. are telling you who the, you know, the coaches are like, this is going to be the captain, it's usually whoever the best pitcher is or right. whoever the, like, person who scores the most is. So, like, it didn't mean anything to me at that age. But then I went to Cornell and it was like, all right, you're involved in a lot of things outside of the field. You know, like, you're sort of an ambassador between the coaches and the players, and you're working on travel, you're working on, like, players starting in the classroom. Like, that was, for me, that was something that, you know, I was really sort of taken aback by when they, because normally juniors aren't captains there. Mm-hmm. And so for them to come to me at that stage, I was like, all right, there's something there. Maybe there's a skill set that I don't think I even realized I had. I was just sort of being who I am. And that's when I started to take a step back and look at the bigger picture of, like, you know, maybe the world is even bigger than I see it. And maybe my skill sets are a little bit different than what I thought they were, and start to really try to align those things. And so that's when I wanted to get into a job where I could start to work with people, manage people, and see how a business really operates.
So how do you get from consulting to starting Zaxby's?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a coffee drinker when I started Zaxby's. I had a friend of a friend who would open up a coffee shop. I was, you know, out doing consulting work in Denver, and I was introduced to this guy's coffee shop, and I don't know what I drank that day. I don't know if it was a latte, a cappuccino, an Americano. It was probably all the above.
Right?
Yes, but I will never forget walking into the cafe, and it was like walking into, you know, a great cafe or into WeWork or something really cool where there's just a buzz and an right. energy that only human beings can create. Not music, not anything else. Like, human beings can create this unique buzz and energy. It's magnetic that I just remember that from walking into that first coffee shop. And I remember looking around, and you couldn't tell whether people were poor or rich, whether they were educated or uneducated, whether they were Jewish or Christian, whether they were gay or straight. You just couldn't tell. It was just people who liked to be around other people and were respectful of other people and were magnetized by other human beings. And I'm like, wow, this is my kind of place. And then I, you know, the next 2 weeks I started to study the industry. I'm like, what's going on with the industry? You certainly hear about Starbucks, but I thought it was just like a little niche sort of thing. I started to realize it wasn't a very niche little thing. You know, it was a huge, huge business that was growing rapidly. It was certainly dominated sort of in the press by Starbucks. Mm-hmm. But one in four coffee shops then and even really today are non-Starbucks. You know, so you have this big company that really creates waves. And you've got a lot of other companies that if their boat, even if it's really small, is well built, when the wave goes up, those boats go up with it. You know, and so it didn't take me long. It took me 2 weeks to say I'm quitting a consulting job and I'm going into this people industry. And that's the way I looked at it. You know, I looked at it as...
Yeah. Were you concerned about Starbucks being as big as it was? Was it, you know, it probably wasn't quite big then, but you're taking on the, you know.
I don't think I was, and I don't know that that's because it was bravery. It was probably more like naivete than anything. I know that other people were very concerned about how big Starbucks was, but it's funny, like, I think about it now, where I just think I have more clarity in yeah, the way that I look at both my business and other businesses. Like, I'm a huge proponent of people opening businesses in big industries. Like, I really, really like that. I think it's easier to create a slice of a pie that's already there and large than it is to create a pie that doesn't exist.
Right. You know there's a need or
yeah, that's an just so like hard to do. You know, it's so hard to do. Not impossible, and it's really phenomenal when you can create social media platform like Facebook, but like, that's just so hard and rare to actually do. So I've always been, whether I realize it then or not, I've always been sort of attracted to the big pie. And so I root for Starbucks. When Starbucks does well, the industry does well. You know, and when Starbucks, the last time they struggled, which was you know, about 2008, 2009, when Starbucks started closing locations or comp sales were down, people would come up to me and be like, Nick, people are going to stop drinking coffee. The coffee industry is going to fall apart, you know? And so no one has said that to me in 8 years, well, you know? But once Starbucks starts to have a little bit of a dip or their sales off, and people are going to be like, Nick, all right, we're done with coffee. Tease the next thing. Or now it's, you know, this or that. So I've always rooted for them because I think that they, you know, they create the large waves that we can ride on.
Let me ask you, what's the most surprising place you found yourself, whether it was a job, a location, or engaging with someone you're like, you know, kind of pinching yourself, like, how did I end up here?
So there's probably a lot, but the one that comes to me, because I've been talking about it a lot recently, is it was probably about 3 years ago, Steve Case, the founder of AOL, was doing this national tour called The Rise of the Rest. So he was contributing a significant amount of capital into the entrepreneurial space, and pretty much everywhere but New York, Boston, and Silicon Valley. So it's really trying to like grow entrepreneurship outside of those three places where it's not normal, but it should be, you know, like big cities like Philadelphia. So Steve comes here, and there was, you know, it was a whole day of events. So Steve was coming here with his team, and it was going to start with this like private breakfast, and then they were going to tour a bunch of different entrepreneurial businesses in Philadelphia. And then that day was going to be the finals of the business plan competition. Mm-hmm. So that morning, a couple weeks before, I'd gotten an email saying, hey, Nick, we'd like you to attend this breakfast. So there's a breakfast in the original Continental in Old City. So mm-hmm. Steven Starr's original restaurant in Old City. And there were probably only about 30 of us. So it's Steve Case, Mayor Nutter. And it's some of the just best and brightest and most important Philadelphians, you know, like the Alan Doms of the world and Josh Kopman and Wayne Kimmel, like people who have done so much for the city of Philadelphia, and me. And so I'm looking around, I'm like, is someone in Philadelphia named very similar to me that, you know, so they somehow mixed up the invites? But
some confusion.
I thought there was some confusion, but I tried to play it as cool as possible that I should be there. And that was big for me because Steve, I remember one, I think it was Arch Nasahai, or it might have even been Mayor Nutter, someone pointed at me, they're like, Nick, what do you love about being in Philadelphia? And I was like, because I was somewhat new to Philadelphia at that time. And
especially an outsider who's coming.
Exactly. So it was fun for me to be able to share what I loved about Philadelphia. But at the end, they had asked Steve, like, look, Steve, you've done so much for entrepreneurship across the country. You've really rolled your sleeves up and dug in. Like, Silicon Valley obviously has technology. Boston's a great technology city. New York's got great finance technology. Like, there's a lot of these things that people are sort of specialized in. What do you think is natural for us in Philadelphia? And he didn't blink. And he said, Philadelphia should be the social entrepreneurship capital of the world. He's like, you have all the makings to be the social entrepreneurship capital of the world. You have all these places of higher education. You have all these massive institutions like Comcast, not just our higher ed, but you know, GSK, all these massive organizations. And then you have young people. So that's the energy that can make a difference. And oh, by the way, we're also the poorest big city in America. Mm. You know, we have a school district that's not working for our young people. Like, we've got all of the need and all the capacity to be the social entrepreneurship capital. And I mean, you know me, you know what we're doing with our business. Like, that was really special for me to be in that room.
You know, Saxby's has done very well. You're growing incredibly fast. Was there a point, or is there a point you've considered yourself, you know, I've made it, I'm a success?
You know, I think that breakfast certainly gave me like a little bit of confidence where I was like, you know what, I think some of the things that we're doing, whether I think it's important or enough or not, other people think that there's something there. But we're a total work in progress. You know, I mean, we rebuilt this business 4 years ago. You know, we were exclusively franchised. We weren't good at operating. We weren't good at supporting franchisees. We were, you know, we hadn't really differentiated ourselves in the marketplace. And a private equity group came and invested in Saxby's and invested in mine and our dream to make this business something completely different and better than what it was at that time. So we've been rebuilding the business over the last 4 years. And I think this new Saxby's really has debuted in the last like 12 to 18 months. So I don't feel like, you know, there's a time yet that I feel like I'm successful, but I think that we're getting there. I think that we're getting there. I think that we're starting to really deliver on this idea of make life better, you know, and making life better for people and places and communities that are fully aligned with what we do, which is operate these, you know, neighborhood important cafes.
So let me ask you about you talked about Starbucks at one point, and whether if it's not doing well, people start to, you know, get a little nervous. What do you think is next for sort of the coffee industry?
Look, it's a really interesting time in coffee, you know. So you have people oftentimes talk about it in these waves. So your first wave is like what we grew up in, like parents, grandparents choking down Folgers, freeze-dried coffee in the morning. It was literally just a stimulant. That's all it was. Starbucks comes around, you know, pretty much. You know, Starbucks was created in the 60s, but it wasn't until Howard Schultz came in like the late 70s, early 80s, where he really put the business on the map as like this idea of like a third place. Mm-hmm. And then most cities didn't start getting their Starbucks until like the 90s or even the 2000s. So there's sort of like the second wave where coffee becomes so much more than just that stimulant. And the product line starts to really widen, these things like Frappuccinos and these other things. And then you have a lot of these people that spin out of Starbucks, people that literally worked for Starbucks, like Todd Carmichael from La Colombe, who's a phenomenal coffee entrepreneur, worked as a barista one time in Starbucks. So they say, you know what? There's a way to do some of these things with better product. So the third wave was very sort of tied to the idea of product.
Where you get the coffee beans and
where you get the beans, like the quality of training that goes into it. It's a little bit more. It's more
the
customized.
Science of
the more science of it. So it, you know, some would argue like the higher quality version of it. So we're at this very. But oftentimes those third wave companies really deprioritize the human experience. Mm. You know, so you were being served by people that took the product very seriously.
Sort of, you think the emergence of what people refer to as the coffee snob, you know, there's to be some of that.
Yeah, so it's like the coffee snob, the third wave can sort of be, in many ways, it can sort of be synonymous with each other. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to come into this world right now, though, where companies are as focused and take as seriously the product as they do the human experience. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a big area where we are right now, but you're seeing a ton of capital be poured into the coffee business. So JAB is this big German private equity group, has recently rolled up a ton of really good, really big coffee companies in America, like Caribou and Pete's and Intelligentsia. Mm-hmm. And then you have a really great company called Blue Bottle, which is out of San Francisco. Very, very prototypical third wave company. Was just acquired for a massive, you know, about $500 million sum by Nestle. Yeah, which happens to be the largest coffee company in the world just by movement of product, but not necessarily one that's been known for high quality. So you see these, you know, companies that are really, really tangential from each other starting to come together. So there's a lot of movement in this industry, which I think is really, really good. But it's just it's forced us to continue to double and triple down on what we do best, which is human experience.
Go from there, and what's next for Saxby's? So it seemed, from my outside perspective, it seems like the university landscape has been a place where you've definitely been, you know, between the Drexel thing and other places that you have.
Yeah.
Strategic that yep. you want to be at universities. Is that yeah. is that going to be continue that you want to be at all universities, or, you know, what's Saxby's kind of strategic vision for where they're going?
Yes, I mean, we're really focused on two types of growth right now. What we call college growth mm-hmm. and then urban professional growth. So the college growth comes through predominantly a program called the Experiential Learning Program, mm-hmm. which you mentioned at the outset. So that was a very unique partnership that we created with Drexel and their incredibly innovative president, John Fry, back in 2015. So we opened up a cafe in the middle of the city, in the middle of Drexel's campus, that was both designed by undergraduate students and has been exclusively run by Drexel students for full academic credit. Nothing like it exists in the coffee industry or any other industry. I mean, it's really a quintessential.
How did that come about?
I mean, it came. That's a really long story, okay. And your listeners nor you probably want to sit through all of it. But we'll take the short version of it. Is you know, the whole idea of you take lemons and you make some lemonade. I started to foolishly franchise this business right out of the gates. I love the idea of partnering with other people to work hard, celebrate successes together, commiserate over failures. But what I noticed was when franchisees weren't owner-operators, when they weren't as in love with and put the effort into their business as like I was with Saxby's, they weren't successful. So we were looking for a way to be able to franchise, quote-unquote franchise, but in a model that wasn't your prototypical franchising. And at the same time, our best performing locations were on or adjacent to college campuses. Our brand, the ethos of our brand, our products, the unique design of every one of our cafes really has resonated with young people for the past decade or so. Mm-hmm. So we're doing well on college campuses. You know, we had a way of potentially modernizing franchising a little bit differently. But the third thing that I saw, spending as much time as I have in higher ed and in the classroom, is unlike when I was graduating school and we didn't teach entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. we're teaching entrepreneurship everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And as great as what we're learning in the classroom and the textbook portion of entrepreneurship is, the pedagogy of higher ed right now is talking about experiential learning. So how do we take the learning that we're doing in the classroom and then have a laboratory, a real-world laboratory portion, and they're calling that experiential learning. And so, you know, being a Cornell hospitality guy and on their staff for a long time, that's quintessential Cornell hospitality. So one of the things that's legendary about their program is they teach business through the operation of a hotel. And so, you know, it's like, here's what you learn in the classroom, how to take inventory, your cost of goods sold, and then you apply it into the operation of this hotel. So I'm like,
I think every university should do that.
I agree. And so
the theory and practice for me, you know, it's like I went to, you know, the kind of ivory tower when you think of universities as being kind of, you know, centers of learning is great.
Yep.
But for me, I think the practicalities of the costs and other reasons that people actually learn what they want to do, you know, they need the experience.
John,
you know?
Fry says it all the time. He's like, we're constantly under fire for justifying an ROI to moms, dads, right. grandparents, and ultimately the students that are coming here. So that ROI, how do you give people the skills that they need to not only go and do something really well, but to actually love what they're going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, and so experiential learning is becoming really, really big, not just in the space of entrepreneurship. And so it was honestly just a mashup of all of those things. And the fact that we're here in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. we're in this incredible city. And so I pitched President Fry this idea. And he said, Nick, we're looking to do unique things like this. We want to give our students this kind of opportunity. So we opened it up, and quite candidly, I thought it was just a really good initial idea. John's the one who really thought it was something way bigger. Mm-hmm. The day that we opened, the students just started pouring in there as if it should have been there forever. He goes, Nick, this is something that needs to scale. Like, this is something that needs to be on, in his words, every single college campus. And so I'm just trying to keep up with his challenge at this point, you know? And so we've started to really scale that program. And, you know, we're going to be in a position by next year where hundreds, if not thousands of students are getting the opportunity, you know, across, you know, dozens of campuses to be able to run their own business. And I think about when I was 22, when I had a couple life experiences, but I couldn't manage people. Right. I didn't know what a profit and loss statement was, let alone actually make business decisions, motivate and put a team in position to be able to make a P&L look good.
And have you found that students rise to the challenge and are doing well as a, you know, from a business perspective, how are they performing as opposed to other ones that are franchised to
candidly
other?
Way better than I thought. Way better than I thought. I had some nightmares that, like, are they going to show up? Right. You know, and how wrong was I? You know, how wrong was I? And after we started to, like, really grow the business and start opening other locations, I started to realize we weren't just getting lucky or picking the one right person. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what happens when people are aligned, have a cultural alignment with a business, and they get to do something they love. You know, because this isn't rocket science. Like, we're not, I am certainly not Elon Musk. I'm not trying to build a rocket and put it on Mars. We're not curing cancer. But when you can hire people that love people and are, like we call, embrace being odd, outgoing, detailing, and disciplined, and you put them in this environment, we train, we support, and then we empower them to do their thing. When you're culturally aligned, it's amazing how well they do it. It's amazing how well they do it. But if you take someone and look, they're like, I want to be a lab scientist, and I want to put on my earphones, and I want to like focus on what I'm doing, and I don't really want to communicate with other people, they're not going to thrive in this environment.
Right.
You know, so it's really about, it's about the right input for us, the right fit. So I've been blown away at how well they do it. And then you just, it's creating something different. I never wanted to just create a coffee company. I didn't want to just like, oh, it's just another coffee company that we have. It was never about that for me.
Do you find that still a challenge for people to see Saxby's as more than just another coffee company?
Much less today. Wow. You know, I think as we proliferate our experiential learning program, and then what that does, you know, when you've got 20, 21-year-olds that are like running seven-figure businesses for you, like, and they're managing 25, 30 of your peers, most times when they graduate, they want to come stay in your business. And so we are populating Saxby's with people that are culturally aligned and highly experienced. You know, they're like business ninjas. Like, they're incredibly advanced at such a young age. So that allows us opportunities. When we open up down the street here at 1818 Market or 1800 Chestnut, we're opening with these cafes that are completely and uniquely designed from one another. So they were designed for that individual neighborhood or that building that they're going into. But then they are being run by people that are empowered entrepreneurs. You know, we're a very decentralized company. And I think that that allows us to be so much more than just good coffee, because good coffee is just the ante to get in the game. You better have good product. If you want to be sitting at the table, you better have good product. If you want to compete and actually win, you better do something way more than that. And we do the way more than that for us is the human side of the business.
It's you know, Simon Sinek.
Of course,
you
know, and Power
so,
Blind.
Yeah, so that to me speaks just to that. It can't be just your product. Yeah, you have to have a threshold of the product being good enough that people are going to want to drink it. But beyond that, you need to have a reason for people to keep coming back.
Yep, that's exactly right.
What career do you think you might have ended up if you hadn't found coffee?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when people ask me, like, what else would you...
Or what you might end up doing.
Exactly. What would you do? You know, I always say that, you know, I feel like I've found my calling. Like, this is the thing that I would love, because this allows me to be challenged as a CEO. You know, it allows me the challenge of, like, we're private equity backed. I have a board that I report to. I have a management team. And we have hundreds of generally young people and people of all different backgrounds. Like, that's a challenge in and of itself, and I love that. But that's also the vehicle for us to make social impact. And I love that those two things are totally aligned. You know, I'm drawn to higher ed. I'm drawn to the idea that, you know, I still think that, especially in this global economy, for all the faults that our higher ed system has, tuition's out of whack, you know, our tenure system, like, there's too much of an ivory tower, for all the challenges that we have in higher ed, it's still one of our greatest exports. And I think it will be, you know, as long as you and I are going to be on this earth. And so I have a natural draw to that. So I'm finding more and more of, you know, just an attraction to that side. So I think that as you know, Saxby's continues to grow, I want to continue to build this bridge, this like public-private partnership where we can leverage the things that we do really well, not to change higher ed, but to allow them, the enhancements, be the laboratory portion of the great things that we're teaching in the classroom. So the higher ed space is an area where I think that, like, that's a great calling for me.
If you could go back in time and change one decision you made, what would it be?
So, I mean, there's definitely a lot.
Would you have gone to the minor leagues?
No, absolutely not. You know, it's funny. I got to watch my brother do that. You know, my brother played a bunch of years in the minor leagues. He had an amazing career. Made it all at AAA. He was on all-star teams. Like, it was really awesome. So I feel like for me, that scratch was sort of itched through my brother. And it was great for him. My brother wanted to be a baseball coach. And he's a really successful high school baseball coach in Atlanta. Like, that is his passion. He thinks what I do, the hours that I work, I live in a dense, big city. He thinks I'm out of my mind. And he drives a huge pickup truck, and he's living in, like, where you can hear animals all over the place. I think he's out of his mind, you know. But, like, we're doing what we both, you know, individually love. If I could change anything, you know, I'm not much for regrets. I think I always point to, franchising. Like, franchising out of the gates was a really foolish thing. Yeah, I always say that I didn't write a business plan. I didn't raise capital. So I put $150,000 on my credit card to start Zaxby's, and I started franchising from day one. So most people are like, no business plan. And that's the worst decision. No, franchising was worse. But I really genuinely believe that if I didn't do that, if I didn't take my lumps in doing that,
you would have grown. And
I would have never figured out the experiential learning program. That would have never come out as a result.
I quote this to a lot of people, which is John Lennon said, you know, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans.
Yeah. So, well, I'm a big believer in, you know, the world happens for you, not to you. Mm-hmm. And so I think I deal with that a lot better at this age. You know, something arguably bad or something that you didn't expect to happen happens. I'm much better now at almost putting a smile on my face and taking a step back, being like, okay, this happened for a reason. You know, like, let me try to read the tea leaves and figure that out. So, you know, what would I have done differently? It's hard for me to think that, because I would normally point to franchising because mm-hmm. of the challenge there, but I don't honestly think that our experiential learning program right. would have come out. I think writing a business plan, you know, like, I would have figured things out sooner had I actually written a business plan. That was the one thing. But I get to sort of...
So you recommend anyone who's kind of starting a business, they should really spend the time to write a business plan.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, forever when we started teaching, so call go 10 years back, we started teaching entrepreneurship in higher ed, and it was like business plan. Now I see people in my office hours at Cornell, people just on the street, they're like, Nick, is a business plan overblown? I'm like, no. You know, if you think that you're going to write a business plan and from point A to point Z is going to work perfectly, right. yes, that's overblown. But a business plan is a roadmap. If you want, you know, you want to go from here to here, mm-hmm. and you lay out your steps, but when you get to point B, you think you're supposed to take a right, but you need to take a left.
Take a left.
At least you still know where you're trying to go. So you take a left and you have to recalibrate. And that's what a business plan does. And so I am a huge proponent of that. And I think that I was just too foolish and naive to realize I should have done that. And I wish I could have done that again. It would have forced me to think more about competition. And most importantly, how are we going to differentiate? I didn't realize that until 5 years into the operation. I think I would have at least figured it out, or been closer to figuring it out, if I would have written a business plan initially.
Okay, now it's time for the 9 rapid fire questions, although sometimes they're not so rapid, but yeah. we'll do our best. Is it better to be a planner or a doer?
Doer.
Are you more risk taker or more risk averse?
Risk taker.
Is it better to make connections online or offline?
Offline.
What's more important, the journey or the destination?
Destination.
Name something on your bucket list.
Ooh, you even gave me a tease to that too. Somewhere
you'd like to go, you've never been. We'll make it easy.
Yeah, I mean, I love traveling. You know what? I've never been to London. I'm a city guy, and I'm actually going to London in March. So I think that's going to be I love to just be able to like walk the streets and get lost and pretend I'm a London's local. Great. So I'm excited to be able to go there.
London's great. My wife is from England, so
awesome! Yeah.
What one book would you recommend to help people be more successful?
Setting the Table by Danny Meyer.
We'll put that in the show notes. Name one of your favorite movies.
I'm as everyone, including my wife, will tell you, I'm not much of a music or movie person. Hoop Dreams.
What would the title of your autobiography be?
Do As I Say, Not As I Did.
If you could be credited with inventing something, what would it be and why?
Something that currently exists?
Either something that exists or something that doesn't exist.
I would love to be credited with an experiential learning program that creates a tremendous bridge between, you know, in public-private partnerships between higher ed and private businesses.
Well, thanks so much. Is there anything at the moment, you're involved with a lot of different projects, both not just with Zaxby's, but is there anything that you are promoting? You want to, you know, you've given me your time. I just want to give you an opportunity to shout out anything that you want people to know about.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really amazing things, you know, happening right now. I think that, you know, one, I recently joined the board of the Community College of Philadelphia, which is a tremendously important institution for this region. Because we do have our challenges in education and affordability and access to great education. And we have a great president there, Guy Generals, who is really sort of breaking down the ivory tower and the fortress, the way that CCP has historically operated. So I'm really excited to start leaning in and dive in there. We're actually creating a scholarship program that we'll be announcing in the next couple of weeks in conjunction with with CCP. But yeah, I mean, I think that's it. I mean, I'm yeah.
And how do people find you and Saxby's online, you know, on social media?
So saxbyscoffee.com, you know, and Saxby's Coffee, which our name is now just Saxby's, but we've been Saxby's Coffee for 10 years. We just dropped the word coffee and went through a big brand evolution back in April. But I love Twitter, you know, so I'm on Twitter at Nick Bayer. I think it's a tremendous place to catch news and promote what you think is interesting and cool happening in the world.
Great. Nick, I really want to say thank you again for coming in here and sharing your story and your perspective, and thank you for helping us connect the dots. Hey there, podcast listeners. Thanks so much for giving me your attention. I appreciate your time. And if you made it this far to this outro, that means you may have listened to the whole podcast, which is awesome. My hope is you got some value, some little nugget out of this piece of edutainment. If so, I'd be very grateful if you would subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a glowing review, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. You can visit our website, 9Dots Podcasts, for all the deep, rich content. Thanks again for helping me connect the dots.